woke up this morning with the sun down shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the news, so, you know... That's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis.
I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sun down shining in.
Hello and welcome back to Stacks and Jacks. I'm Tom Al. Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 23. NASDAQ Futures up 164 as we continue our march. So, Greg, you got to use so many cuss words?
Damn.
Yeah. What the bleep are you talking about? Do we have Professor Lou?
Good morning.
Hey, how are you?
Oh, I'm awake. I want to talk about one of these crucial issues of the day, and that's airline boarding.
I haven't been on a plane in a while. How bad is it getting?
It's getting pretty bad. And what triggered my interest was the fact that American Airlines is apparently going to do something that I think they should have done a long time ago, but they're basically programming their boarding pass readers so that if you try to board in a group that's not been called, you know, they board almost all airlines now use a group boarding type of scenario because they want to reward their priority passengers with the ability to get on the airplane first and get their bags in the overhead bins. So you board, I mean, I think United's got five groups and whatever. The only one that doesn't use that kind of, you know, go in and select your own seat is Southwest, and they're moving to that pattern. Anyway, the boarding group deal is sort of a hit or miss, or has always been kind of a hit or miss thing. And you typically will have people who get in, you know, don't board with their group because the rush is on to get, you know, to get to a spot where you put your bags in the overhead bin.
It's a fight for the overhead bin, right?
Yeah, because people don't want to check bags because it costs you money to check bags and you have to wait for your bag, and so you want to try to fly with carry-on luggage whenever possible. So American has now gone to the system where, and they're enforcing it, where if you get in a line and your boarding pass shows a group that hasn't been called or that is you know, behind the group that's currently boarding, they kick you out. They kick you off the line and make you go to the back of the line and get in with your proper group. And they're enforcing it. And it's something that I've always, I've always thought, why are we not doing this? But it apparently is going to go into effect. They've rolled out a hard test of it in a couple of airports.
I bet it was a hard test.
Pardon me?
I bet it was a hard test. People were pissed off.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. That's right. People go, wait a minute. You know, it's the same issue that you see with the size of carry-on bags issue. And this hit me on my last trip to Europe where we were flying on Lufthansa. And, you know, each airline has kind of a size limitation on how much you're supposed to be taking on those overheads. And it's a size issue for American Airlines, for U.S. Airlines, but it's a weight issue, size and weight issue for the European Airlines. So your carry-ons on Lufthansa are limited to 7 kilograms,
which is what?
Is 15.2 pounds or something like that. And if it, and they weigh them, So if you come on the airplane with and if you get in line with that, they force you to gate check it, and a gate check surcharge. This is not, you know, like U.S. airlines, where they stupidly say, you know, we'll just gate check your bag for you, and you can pick it up on your exit as you exit the aircraft at the ramp there. The Germans and several other European airlines charge you an additional 100 euro if they have to gate check your bag, because it's a hassle. And so you're sitting there thinking, as you're packing your bags, I've actually got to weigh this thing, because trust me, a light carry-on on Lufthansa, a rollerboard, is I think the limit there is 22 kilograms, and then 25 pounds, so 12 kilograms, and then your other carry-on is 7, and so I promise you that my average rollerboard when I'm packing for a trip weighs more than 22 pounds or 25 pounds.
Well, if you ever, I mean, I've not flown in a while, but I know, obviously, was aware of the game. It seems like whenever people, not only are they, some people have the social grace of a wildebeest, but not only do they have a big carry-on, they throw it like in the middle, taking up the whole deal. So inevitably, you get one of the smaller flight attendants pulling these things out and rearranging them. I don't want those ladies or guys winging all bags over their head 40 pounds their whole life. Why should they?
Well,
have
that's
to do
right.
That?
And a lot of times they won't do it.
Yeah, I'm saying. Last time I flew, every time I flew, they always had the little thing at the end. If your bag doesn't fit in here, don't bring it out. I never once saw anybody say, "Hey, see if the thing fits in there."
Well, they some of the airlines have gone to using sizing baskets out in front of the.
They were there 100 years, and nobody ever used them.
That's right. As you come in, well, I've never seen anybody run a check on that. And one of the interesting aspects of this, again, you know, it's the old line about this is why we can't have nice things. When you defer to the judgment, you know, sort of a collective sense of judgment on the part of the passengers, you've got a sizable percentage of the population that says, you know what, I'm going to take advantage. You know, everybody else might be playing by the rules, but I don't have to, and so I'm going to take advantage of the situation. And that's apparently what's going on with this line enforcement. But it's going to be an issue. And I read that story. I follow a couple of frequent flyer blogs. And read that story, and I thought, good, thank God, because we don't, you know, we're getting to the point where it's this kind of mad rush. And if you fly on some of the discount airlines, like Frontier, for example, where I saw the basically what looked like a mob rush the gate when they called for boarding, and I thought, what? 'Cause I don't typically fly Frontier. I was unfamiliar with the process. My reaction was, what are they doing? And it was because they didn't enforce their groups. They called boarding group A, and the entire population of that aircraft got up out of the and charged the gate.
Well,
they knew it was going to be enforced, and they wanted to get their bags into those bins.
Well, Southwest Air, when we used to do a lot of seminars around the country back when people really wanted to learn how to trade options and futures and so forth, we give seminars. My brother was going every couple of weeks, and he loved going on Southwest, and he was A personnel. He flew enough to where he was always an A guy, which gets you on first, right? And which was fine, because then you get to pick your seat. There's no first class or anything there, but you get to at least get to pick a window or an aisle or something. So somehow or another, I'm taking Southwest Air back from Vegas, right? And it's, you know, pretty early morning flight. I was doing a seminar for the SIBO, and I get out to Southwest there, and of course you've got.
And had you checked in an hour early or 24 hours early to get your place in line? Or did you check in at the airport?
I think my brother did it for me. Yeah, I didn't know how to
okay.
do it. Okay. Yeah, so I was B personnel, I think, which is okay. It's all right as long as I get an hour window. I don't care. I mean, I'd love to get as tall as I am. I'd love to get the exit row, but sometimes you can't get that. Anyway, so. There's a line ahead of A, which is like people that are like handicapped or something.
Oh yeah, this is the new, yeah.
This is years ago. So if your leg is in a cast or something, you know, you get to go on that line. But also the people that are sitting with you.
Right.
So there's this guy. I think he must have been trashed the night before, and somehow slipped or something. He kind of sprained his ankle. So he's got, he must have gone to the emergency room, but he got, you know, it's like an elastic bandage on his ankle, right? So he's in this line with like five or six of the most hungover dudes with him. They must not even go to bed. They're all in line. They're like his family. So all seven of them are in the handicap line. And they had seven drunks. One guy with an elastic bandage around his ankle. And I'm going, you know, I think they're taking advantage of this just a hair.
Well, I think I don't know if I've told you about the JetBridge Jesus phenomenon. So older and in many cases very overweight or very overweight people are getting wheelchairs to be pushed through the airport. The airport provides the service for free. So if you and Southwest is notorious for this, but it's also other airlines, you'll line up to get on the airplane, and the most I've counted I think was 21 wheelchairs lined up, because that gets you priority boarding. So you've got 21 people in wheelchairs plus, you know, various hangers on, you know, the posse that's going with them, and they're lined up separate and apart. Now at the other end of the flight, you come off the jet bridge, and there are 21 wheelchairs there, of which, according to the last gate agent I talked to, maybe five or six will actually be used, because all those people who needed wheelchairs to get on the airplane are suddenly miraculously healed by JetBridge Jesus as they come off the airplane, and all of a sudden they don't need those wheelchairs anymore because they don't need the priority. They don't want the priority to get on the aircraft.
My phone is flying here, ringing off the hook. What is Lou doing in steerage in that first class?
Oh yeah, yeah, right. I don't fly first class.
How does Lou know what's going on in coach?
I know lots of coach stories. It's how I roll. And I used to fly Southwest all the time. And Southwest, you know, Southwest very, very intelligently said, look, one of our markers is our efficiency at getting people on the aircraft, getting them turned around and getting them out of there. And that's one of the reasons they don't charge for bags. And because they want to encourage people to check bags.
Yeah.
So if you're not having to pay $70 to check two bags or whatever it is on United now, you will check your bag, and you're not getting on the airplane with a giant, you know, rollerboard and a guitar and you know, skis and whatever else you're trying to haul onto the aircraft. That's going away. They're going to start charging for bags. You know, they're changing one of the big stories. They're changing the entire seating structure.
I know what I'm saying.
They're going to start reserving seats.
Right. And, well, but this has been going on. The planning has been for a while. It hasn't happened yet.
Well, they're going to start next year or start next year, I think. But no, the takeover group, the investment group, has been screaming about it for the last 18 months, saying, look at all the revenue we're losing, look at all this, look at all that. Southwest finally bent the knee to these guys. Their CEO departed, bent the knee to these guys and said, okay, fine, we'll do this. But apparently, again, this is why you can't have nice things. Southwest policies that facilitated this rapid boarding and rapid turnaround of aircraft required a certain amount of go along, get along spirit on the part of the passengers. For example, if you get on the aircraft, people want to sit together, but invariably they don't get their boarding numbers lined up properly. So one person gets on and another person might be in another group way far behind. And Southwest is adamant about you're not allowed to save seats. And yet people do. And so there, you know, every Southwest flight I've been on, somebody wants to sit somewhere, and somebody else says, well, that seat's reserved, and you can't do it. And so Southwest, you know, passengers were saying, I don't want to mess with this. I want a ticket that gives me a seat number so I know where I'm sitting.
Well, because the husband and wife traveler want to sit together. I mean, but I have an economic question about this thing. I used to fly Southwest a lot. As a matter of fact, for a while, I mean, I don't fly that much. My brother flew a lot more than me. I'm going to say it was 10, 12 in a row at Southwest. And in the early days, where you know, if you went to Vegas, you had to stop. I don't even think the 737-200s could make it to Vegas from Chicago, but maybe they could, but there was always a stop. The stop, the guy'd land, and he drives like 75 miles an hour to the gate and damn near screech into the gate. You couldn't have been on the ground 10 minutes between the people getting off and people getting on, and they're backing out before people are even in their seat.
They could turn an airplane, and I think it was they set the industry standard for turning airplanes.
Yeah,
I think they could turn an airplane in like 20 minutes.
Well, because they didn't wait till you're sitting down before the guy started backing up. But here's my question. So finally, I turn around and I go back to American United flight. Now, the Southwest, you get there, you line up, you get on, and everybody was pretty polite in those days, like you said. And it was no big deal. On and off you go. And then I'd go see, I'd forgotten all about the choreography at the desk where every blooming idiot wants to see if he can upgrade the first class, and they're calling this name out and that for this big mess in front of this desk where everybody's trying to upgrade and do this and change seats.
That's all automated now.
Okay, but I'm saying it wasn't, and I'm thinking this is a disaster. The Southwest plane has to be able to take at least one more round trip a day than one of these guys messing around out here.
Yep, and that's why their airfares, the big distinguishing feature of Southwest early on, it's not quite as the same now, was the fact that their airfares were very cheap. They were much cheaper, and they delivered a level of service, and they still do. They delivered a level of service that was comparable with much more expensive airlines, as opposed to somebody like Spirit, which, God help you if you ever fly Spirit Airlines. Have you ever done that?
No, I was going to ask if you ever flew Peoples.
No, but Spirit is, you know, I've flown JetBlue, so that's probably comparable to Peoples. But Spirit is, you know, you buy, essentially what you're buying is a seat. You don't buy water. You don't buy, and maybe a bathroom. I don't know if they're charging for bathrooms now. If you want to talk to a live person, for example, on your ticket reservation, if you need to modify it, that's like $25. If you want to carry on anything other than like a purse, that's an upcharge. If you have to check a bag, that's an upcharge. If you want to pick your seat before boarding, that's an upcharge. Otherwise, you just get a seat randomly assigned, which, of course, you know what that means. That means a middle seat.
Yeah.
So that's the bargain basement level of service, and it reflects. And their airplanes are constantly late, and they're not reliable. And so I would say they're kind of a last resort. Although you see them in and out of Vegas all the time.
The people, this is before 9/11. You got on the plane without a ticket. You bought the ticket.
Right,
the
I
plane.
Remember that. You bought it. It was like an old train situation where you bought your ticket from the conductor.
Well, and the guy would go down the aisle with a cash register.
Yeah.
And you play with a credit card, or you could pay with cash. Hey,
Anyway, this is going to introduce some real conflict for people who travel. And,
well, it would introduce real conflict if they enforced like stop signs too.
This is the same thing that would happen if you hadn't been enforcing stop signs for a while, and now all of a sudden.
Well, that's right. I mean, imagine if you started giving tickets to bikers. By the way, the new powered bikes, the ones where they go a lot faster and you don't have to pedal.
Yeah, the electric bikes, e-bikes.
You have the same rights now as a regular biker regarding stoplights and stop signs, according to them. They don't have to stop either.
People on bicycles and you know, again, we talk, our leadership, our elites talk about the fact that we want to be like Europe, where they use bikes all the time and it's cleaner and da 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 da. And my first response to that, and we have a big group like that here in Denver, and my first response to that is, hey, that's great. I'm all in favor of that if you start enforcing ticketing these people for when they blow through stop signs, stop lights, when they ride on the sidewalks.
It's a whole different package of rights. Hey, we come back, let's talk a little bit, you know, about the cottage industry of who's representing all these people is in this NIL stuff. Plus, actually, we have a gentleman coming out at 7 o'clock. As Dan Janius is on a plane, a friend of mine, longtime friend, he's a civil engineer, talking about hurricane repair and lead times and things like that. Should be real interesting. But
I also want to talk about what the B-2s did last night in Yemen and why that's important.
Okay, and evidently, the gentleman coming on is from Marquette as well, but my friend that I meet on Wednesdays with the lawyers and judges, Bill says to me that the basketball coach at Marquette, now Marquette was a top 20 team last year, maybe even top 10.
Yes.
He's come out and said they're going to be totally traditional, not doing anything in this NIL. Now my question is that even possible? Anyway, SP Futures up 25, NASDAQ Futures up 164. Be right back, Stocks and Jocks.
Have you ever heard the expression, the customer is always right?
Is your business being challenged by the complexities surrounding healthcare reform or other matters related to human resources management? If so, then Cognos HR can help. A longtime friend and contributor to the Stocks and Jocks radio program, Cognos HR provides its clients with a perfect blend of strategic consulting and day-to-day HR management to drive overall improvement in business performance. Companies that join the Cognos HR family are better able to manage healthcare costs, enhance benefit offerings, and improve employee satisfaction by leveraging our access to Fortune 500 benefits. Our innovative onboarding and payroll technology, along with our constant attention to detail, enables us to provide the highest level of quality service to our clients. Now, your time and energy can be focused on generating business and increasing your bottom line. We'll take care of the rest. For more information, call us at 630-401-8810 or search us on the web at CognosHR.com. Cognos HR, innovation in human resources. Licensed in Illinois and Arizona.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now, right now.
Hello and welcome back, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tom Allen. We got Greg Pappas on the board. SP Futures up 25. NASDAQ Futures up 166. Dow Futures up 72. We're just relentlessly, everything moving up. The only thing that's not moving up is if you got $100 in your pocket, you better spend it because it's not worth as much tomorrow, I don't think. We're in that kind of a phase. DAX up 148.8%. FTSE up 33.4%. CAC around up 88. That's 1.2. ECB rate decision is today, I believe. Anyway, we'll see what they do. Over in Asia, Rock'em Sock'em Asia. Nikkei down 270. That's 0.7%. Hang Seng down 207, that's over 1%. Shanghai down 33, that's over 1%. So the policy over there of goose in the market has worked for a while. Now it looks like it's run out of gas. We'll see how that works out. Yesterday, Dow up 337, S&P up 27, NASDAQ up 51. NASDAQ was somewhat of a laggard because a couple of the big stocks came off yesterday. Microsoft was down, but they're all up today. NVIDIA, another $4. Just every time you see NVIDIA up $4, just keep thinking $100 billion, 25 billion shares outstanding. It's really a number that I don't think anybody can really conceive, even though you think you can. 10-year rate 4.04, that's up 2 basis points. The Bund up 3 basis points, 2.20. Japan up 1 basis point, 0.97. We've got oil up 25 cents, 70.64. Brent up 26 cents, 74.48. Natural gas unchanged, 2.37. We have gold up another $11, 2702, over 2700. My clients, we've been kind of sniffing this out for a while, so we're pretty long gold. I wish we were longer. Whenever it goes your way, Greg, don't you always wish you had more? Isn't that the way that works? Silver up 7 cents, 3205. We are also long silver. Copper down 2 cents, 434, but we're probably going to start locking some of this in. I don't know how much further it's going to go. U.S. Dollar 108.7, so the dollar's been pretty strong. British pound 130. It's still hanging above 130. 13009, so it's hanging by a thread. Bitcoin down 922, but still an elevated number, 66,856. Greg, what do you got for us? Traffic, weather, sports.
Good morning, everyone. It is 634 here in Chicago, 37 degrees, high of 64 today. Phoenix, 69 degrees right now, high of 91 there. Traffic, we got inbound Kennedy from Montrose, 24 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 49 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 51 minutes. The Ryan from 95th is 36 minutes. And Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 46 minutes. NBA, Bulls beat the Timberwolves by 2. That was 123 to 125. Dodgers out, shut out the Mets. That was 8-0. And tonight we have the Broncos at the Aints, and that's 7:15 p.m. That's all I got, Chief. Back to you guys.
I heard some incredible rumor, and I don't know if it's rumor or news, you would know, that the Tampa Bay is going to play in Oakland next year?
I don't think it's official or done, but let me check on that one for you. Also, the rumor was Reinsdorf was given his okay to sell the team.
Are you in the bidding? Is Lou putting together a group?
Just something to think about.
Lou, I want to get a deal where we put up $100,000 and borrow the rest like everybody else. Get an interest rate of like 2% somewhere and have the city pay it.
What? So this is the Bulls being sold?
No, the Sox.
The Sox, the White Sox. So what do you think you could get for the White Sox?
I think
$100,000 might do it.
No, you won't. I think the Sox made a fortune last year. I think they ended the year with that much payroll. They paid zero rent. I bet they paid $1.2 million in rent because their attendance was so far down, maybe a little bit more. And I think they get the TV stuff. I don't think you have to sell any kind of cards for the White Sox. Any kind of charity for them.
Mm. I don't know. I want to talk about this. First of all, I got a hard stop at 6. Sorry about that. It's 7 your time.
Yep.
I want to talk real quick about this B-2 strike that hit Yemen yesterday. The B-2 is a stealth bomber. We don't need to use stealth bombers to bomb Yemen. They have very limited air defense. But the B-2 is capable of carrying a weapon that most other U.S. aircraft cannot carry, and that's the 30,000-pound bunker buster. 15-ton bunker buster that has been designed, and I'm not sure if this one is the one that they used in Desert Storm, where they basically took, and you'll appreciate this, 155 millimeter artillery tubes and packed them. So that's what, a six inch tube, and pack them full of explosives. So you got a very narrow tube, put fins on it, pack them full of explosives, and then use them to hit Hussein's underground bunker complex in Iraq. These bombs are unique. They're designed to penetrate up to 100 feet through rock. Little less through reinforced concrete, which is whatever, but that's ostensibly why you would use the B-2 versus, you know, an F-18 or an F-35.
A B-52 could carry it probably, right?
I don't think the bomb bays for the 52 are big enough, and it's not wired for it. It requires a special rack and a bunch of other stuff, and I don't think the 52 has got that kind of capability.
This is the first certainly time.
Certainly in terms of payload, it could carry it, but not in terms of, you know, the logistics of hooking the thing onto the aircraft. But so here's the point. One, who knew that the Houthis were digging underground bunkers to hide weapons and other combat logistics? I mean that's expensive. It takes expertise. It takes a lot of effort. So you sort of wonder, is this Iran coming in and like Hezbollah using the same people that they sent to Gaza and Lebanon to put this stuff in place? Because that's an upgrade. You know, you're not talking about a bunch of guys who are out there just, you know, randomly shooting missiles into the Red Sea. These guys are firing ballistic missiles at targets that are guided with Iranian help, and you know, now they've got underground storage capability. That's something. The second thing is the other people in this region who use underground storage facilities significantly are the Iranians. They're the experts on this, and you know, you sort of send a message to Iran saying, look. First of all, you can't stop the B-2. It's invisible on your radar, and unless you happen to get somebody to get eyeballs on the thing in the middle of the night, you're not gonna be able to detect it. So that thing's gonna get through your air defense, and to the extent that you think you might be able to detect it, we'll stop that. So this thing's gonna come, and we've now demonstrated with your allies. The capability to hit deeply buried targets, which is you. That's your nuclear weapons operations, and it's your main storage facilities for weapons. So we've now demonstrated a capability to hit that thing, and we've demonstrated the willingness to use it, albeit on your proxies. So, you know, ostensibly this is, allegedly this is being seen as a warning to Iran that we're rolling out this.
How many
very
of these bombs do you think we have?
Of those kind of things? I don't have any idea, but I think we have enough that. And what you would do is you would drop these things in sequence. You drop one, it would penetrate, you know, if you're going after something that's hardened concrete. Let's say it penetrates 50 feet and it detonates and it blows a hole in the rubble, and then if there's more stuff buried deeper, say, because supposedly they've put them down like 200 feet, you put another bomb into that rubble area. That thing, because the ground's now been prepped, that thing penetrates another, say, 50 to 100 feet, and it detonates. And then you put a third one in on top of that, and so you progressively basically dig out the underground.
Well, I mean, we don't have 1,000 of these things, do we?
I don't know, but I wouldn't surprise me if we had 1,000 of them, maybe more.
Now, B-2 comes from where? There's only like one base, right?
Whiteman, Missouri.
And they just refueled it and went all the way over there to land somewhere along the way.
Yep, that's what they specialize in. This is something the Air Force has been maintaining for a couple of decades. They refer to it as Global Strike, and it's not quite where they want it yet, because what you want is the ability to identify a target anywhere in the world and hit it within, you know, 30 to 40 minutes.
I thought they were, if they could stage a couple in like Diego Garcia or somebody, if they had to, they could sneak one over there.
They could, but they don't like to, because the thing requires some fairly careful preparation and maintenance, and so they don't want to have to transport all of that. They've got specially designed hangars for them to keep the radar absorbing surfaces protected. They don't want to have to transport all of that to an overseas location.
Well, we talk a lot, I mean, because I don't know why, but maybe because I was in the railroad industry, but logistical issues, which we're going to talk about with Bill Moriarty after Louis has to leave. How many refuelings are we talking about, and how many refueling guys do we have between here and Yemen? I mean,
we have that. I mean, to refuel a couple of B-2s, that's no big deal. To refuel
over Africa?
To refuel 50 aircraft, Chief, flying nonstop from the United States to the Middle East. We were doing that during Gulf War II and Gulf War I. We set up an air bridge.
Do you need a land-based place, or can you refuel from a carrier?
Refuel what?
Can you
the B-2?
Well, the carrier has planes that can refuel people, right?
An aircraft carrier, yeah. So it can refuel. It can keep its fighters in the
air.
But
I mean, could it catch a B-2 along the way?
No. Those aircraft are not set up to refuel a B-2. So you're talking KC-135. These used to be KC-10s. They just retired those. So you're talking either a C-46, KC-46, which is the new tanker, or the KC-135, which is the old one. So one of those. But we have a lot of those.
The old ones are 707, right? Those things are older than the B-2s or the B-1s.
The KC-135s, much older. So you set up an air bridge where those things are launched, and I talked about the logistics of this previously, where you have to have not only the tankers that will refuel that aircraft, and you're probably talking, I think you're talking three refuelings to get from Whiteman to the Middle East. You're talking three refuelings, so you have to have at least three tankers, separate tankers, to hit this aircraft along the way. Plus you have spares for each of those tankers, so that if one drops off, you've got another one you can plug right into it.
Can these things, it's a real stupid question, fully loaded with these heavy bombs, if they had to land with the bomb, can they?
I think so, yeah. Now, whether they would, I don't know. Usually if you can't, when you hang bombs on the outside of the aircraft, if you can't drop them, you just ditch them. But the B-2 carries everything internally. So I don't know whether they would, as a matter of course, land with it. But landing is mainly a matter of gross landing weight.
If they're leaving from the Midwest or wherever, you're going to gas it up. We're on the coast. You're going to gas it up over Spain somewhere, and then somewhere over by Israel or something, right?
Yeah, depending on where the tracks are. Yep.
What does I know you've never been there, but this whole thing to me, and Gaza is sort of the same way. Where boatloads of concrete, steel, all this stuff show up with all these engineers, all these people that are capable of constructing this stuff, and you're wandering past people. There's no streets. There's no heating. There's no air conditioning. There's no toilets. How the hell do you pull that off in a place like that, Lou? I mean, what? How bizarre does that look?
Oh, the question I have is what are the people that live there
that's what I'm trying to ask you, actually.
What do they think when they see this ultra-modern construction operation going on that they don't have any part of? And it's not, Yemen is bad enough, but imagine Gaza, where you're right on top of the people that are doing this building. And you're watching them pour all this concrete and dump all this stuff in, and you're looking around going, we're living in pretty much abject poverty here. And that money that was used to buy all that stuff was supposed to be going to support our infrastructure. Yeah. What do you do?
Let's assume it's Iran.
In Gaza, if you complain, they shoot you. So we understand how that works. I don't know about Yemen, but I presume it's the same thing.
So somehow Iran loads up some big ship with a bunch of concrete trucks. Where do you get the gravel? What's the gravel called in the concrete? You need sand. You need Portland cement, and you need what's the other stuff? The hardest part is to get the good stone, right?
Yeah, the regolith or aggregate or whatever.
Aggregate. Yeah. Sorry. Thank you. So. You show up with this ship, they even have a dock, and all of a sudden the thing comes off, and you got concrete. You got to put together a concrete plant somehow, and then you got to find out where you got aggregate. This is the people there must just be looking at this, going, "What the hell? what is this?"
I would be.
Yeah.
So that, as I said, this is another, another marker of just the craziness of this whole area. We talk about. Well, we have to worry about the welfare of, the people involved in these combat operations. My response is, I care as much about the people in Yemen or Gaza as the leadership of Yemen and Gaza cares about their people. Which is to say,
I think you and I care more.
We probably care more. Yeah, because we're paying to ship food in there that these guys certainly aren't doing to help their people. We're effectively restraining the Israelis. These guys are kidnapping them. The war in Gaza could end tomorrow. All that has to happen is Hamas has to surrender and turn the hostages back, or the bodies of the hostages, which is what I think we're looking at right now. That would end the bombing, but they're not going to do that. And in fact, they want their the Gazan leadership. The Hamas leadership very straightforwardly said, "I want our people killed because it looks good for us."
Yeah, well, it's They're not going to get the virgins like the. I guess maybe they are. Let's get the. You know, it's funny. Once in a while, I go on a rant here and I talk about if the U.S. goes down, the world looks a hell of a lot different. And this morning I'm driving in and they were playing some tapes from the Kennedy-Nixon debate. And John Kennedy said flat out, if we fail, freedom fails.
Yep.
So it's not exactly my thought, but I don't think there's any question you and I care more about these people than the... Real quick, sorry, I know we got a short fuse today, but a friend of mine, she has some system in place. I won't go into it, it's a big deal, but has to do with it's a type of math. You know more about this than me, Lou. It's a type of math where you're not adding and subtracting to get to an answer. It's a way to organize things. It's like coloring problems. You know, which way should you? If you got 15 places to go in your delivery truck, where do you go first and second and third? Right. Those are math problems, but none of the kind of math problems that I was ever very good at. But anyway, she was involved in the United Nations plan to bring this stuff to these countries, like in Africa and places where if a container got on a ship, it was going to be photographed, and where it landed, you know, where destination was to be photographed again, and if the photographs didn't match, they were going to reject it, kind of a thing. And the UN was involved, right? And she's telling me about how they went to like two places in Africa, I forget the name of the countries, and the dictator, it was going to cost, you know, a couple $100 every time you photograph this thing. I mean, it's a big deal. And photograph, talk about a Luddite term, but x-rayed it, whatever you want to call, whatever the taking a picture of the thing. And she says, the dictator's got a Swiss bank account. And every time the $100 comes, we had a kick, like a, we set the account up, we're going to give him a buck. I'm like, you're going to do what? It's so crooked that if you want to do something, you actually got to pay these. We actually make them more empowered by helping to a certain extent,
This is exactly what, if you saw the letter that our idiotic State Department sent out on Tuesday to the government of Israel, a pure public relations ploy, demanding the Israelis stop interfering and making bad publicity against UNRWA, the United Nations Relief Welfare Agency, that has been assisting Hamas directly for, you know, at least two decades down there. And these folks end up in bed with the terrorists. The Israelis know it. They're forcing United Nations personnel out to be able to operate effectively in Gaza and now in southern Lebanon. And we're somehow, because we apparently believe that the UN is a functioning, effective and functioning agency, we're yelling at the we're yelling at the Israelis, hey, you gotta stop that or we're gonna cut military aid off to you. And the Israelis are saying, wait a minute, every time we ship something in there, if it goes through the UN, it goes directly to Hamas. All the food aid we've got, all of our humanitarian stuff that is creating or that is being used to try to mitigate the terrible effects of a war that we didn't start, the United Nations people are getting in the middle of it and screwing it up. They're giving it to the people that created this problem.
We've talked about this on the show. I don't know what the... I mean, I tell you what, if somebody... First of all, you couldn't get me in the Oval Office because I think the place looks like a jail more than a White House. But if I was there, I'm not so sure if we got some of the smartest guys I know and you'd be on that list. I'd like to take one or two countries and just say, okay, the one I would like to take is Nicaragua, because the guy who lived next door to me freshman year at Notre Dame was from Nicaragua, and he had to get out of there because they were after his family and all kinds of stuff, and I don't think things have gotten much better for his people, and I don't know if they got out of there or what they did, but we've given, I think we, the U.S., has probably given a lot of aid to Nicaragua through the years, and or maybe it was El Salvador, one of the places, and at the end of the day, I'd like you and some people as smart as you to be able to say, the long period of time, have we helped or have we hurt? I mean, to walk in there and try and to do stuff with total disregard of the, I'll say, legitimate government, tongue in cheek, you can't do that. But every time you include them, where it looks like they're part of the solution, even though it's your money, all you do is strengthen them. I honestly, I'd love to see what you guys would come up with. I don't know what the solution is there, Lou.
Well, a huge part of the problem is that you have a significant portion of the population that is not interested in helping the other part of the population. There was a great, and we are not used to confronting the political will that says, I want to be number one, or I want to be in power, and if I have to kill everybody in my country to do so, I will do it. There's a great scene. Did you ever read the book, The Ugly American?
Bits and pieces. I think I might have saw that. There's a movie too, right?
Yeah. Fantastic book. Yeah. It's set in a Southeast Asian country, supposed to be Vietnam. But it one of the scenes involves a humanitarian aid being delivered, big bags of rice, you know, that say property, you know, from the people of the United States of America to the people of whatever this, you know, this third world country was. And the aid is being administered by this, you know, charitable organization. You know, they're shipping it in, and suddenly the people that they've been working with, the locals that they've been working with to do this, suddenly show up at their facility with put guns on the Americans, and then start putting Ipecac, you know, the vomiting agent, into the rice, so that it will be distributed and cause everybody to be sick. So they are poisoning.
That's well.
Well, but of course these people are Viet Cong, and they've been working for the Viet Cong all along, and it's a perfect demonstration of political will. We are willing to poison our own people to make you look bad, because your program here is very effective, and it takes care of people. We don't want that. We want our people throwing up, sick, poisoned, and we want them thinking it was you that did it to them, because that will help us down the road. We are not used to confronting that political will, and quite frankly,
I wouldn't exactly call it political will. I just call it about there's nothing like our Declaration of Independence, how each individual has a right or two. They don't care about that.
No, I mean, but that's part of it. I mean, yeah. it's the same mindset that you see in the movie Apocalypse Now, where Marlon Brando describes the scene about going in as a special forces guy and inoculating the village of children against, you know, diphtheria and typhus and a bunch of other stuff, and the VC coming in behind them and basically taking all these kids and cutting their arms off where they've been inoculated. And Brando, and you know, that the screenwriter didn't make that up.
No,
that actually happened.
Yep, it's happened. I know we only got a couple of minutes here, a little bit. I actually was involved.
Anyway, you talk about me. I mean, we try to go into these places. We really don't have a good understanding.
We don't know
of
how
the mentality that we're dealing with.
I congratulate you, because you have actually educated me a hell of a lot during the show.
God help us.
Well, no, I'm saying in terms of everybody, don't always look at everybody through your own mindset, which is what you personally have taught me that. I don't know if you know that or not. Because up until then, I'm like, oh no, those guys, they can't be that big of bleeps. Yes, they are. I mean, yes, they are. I mean, I had a little deal with the guy. I didn't do a deal, but these people from Mexico knew that I have some connections. I mean, I don't, it's not like I'm Mayor Daley or anything.
You know a guy who knows a guy.
Anyway, I know a guy who knows a guy. We got guys, as I say in the South Side. And this guy from Mexico wanted me to put together, find a bank for sale, which, by the way, I could easily have done, because there was a guy that used to listen to the show, and a poor guy died. That's what he did. He liked to research South Side banks in the hopes of putting the banks back together to help to save the neighborhoods. And he and I used to go out to breakfast every few months, and he'd tell me that the bank's available and everything. Terrific guy. I wish I could have done it. And the guy said, well, we need a bank. I said, what do you need a bank for? He said, well, in Mexico, if you pay your tab to the local city, they can't keep the money. They got to ship it to the federal government, and they parcel it out back to them. Okay, it's a whole different program than here, and I'm learning as I'm listening. And he said, but if you overspend, you get a chance, they can borrow against the money that they know is coming. And I'm thinking, I know where this is going. Now, if we had a bank up here, we could, like, lend them the dough. And, oh, by the way, they pay, like, 20% interest. I go, they do what? And the law is, if you can prove that the debt is yours, you get paid back by the federal government on the next installment before the mayor, because they'll think they're not going to give it to him because they're not sure he's going to give it to you. In that country, from a little bit I know, you know, Mexican people stealing money from other Mexican cities is a national sport. You know, here we do some of that. You know, people dodging taxes and all that stuff, but nowhere near on the same level. I mean, there's a reason why Mexico stays the way they are. And it's, you know...
Yeah, you incentivize the wrong stuff.
Yeah, you incentivize the wrong stuff. All right, hey, what are they... These people that are doing all this marketing for all these NIL people, are they? Can they call themselves agents now, or are they not agents?
No, they're not. They're not agents. They're something else. And I got a hard stop,
right,
Chief.
Right, so. Take care, buddy. As usual, good stuff. SP futures up 23. NASDAQ futures up 167. What do you say, Greg? We go about a 2-second break and bring on Mr. Bill Moriarty.
I'm an American. You're sick.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI Pro Direct. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI Pro Direct can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI Pro Direct. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com. PTIProDirect.com.
It wasn't lies. It was just
You might have to let that one go a little bit, Greg. That's Sheena Easton, right? Is the S&P futures up 23, NASDAQ futures up 170. Mr. Greg Pappas, our producer, that was an all-time high, right? We're an all-time high for the Dow. You could let that one go a little bit.
Nah, we'll skip it.
We'll skip it? How would you like to have Sheena Easton singing that to you? There you go.
All right, that's enough.
That's enough. That's enough. Do we have Mr. Bill Moriarty?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good. How are you, buddy?
Doing okay. What an honor to be on Stocks and Jocks.
Well, we had the guy yesterday out of the blue to call and gave us the long dissertation on how the teams move up and down in Britain. I thought that was fascinating.
Yeah, I don't think I heard that part, but I always listen to your show as a podcast in the evening, and sometimes I don't last through the whole show, but I hear
we put you to sleep. Well, that's a good way.
Sometimes, yes.
But the question was about the college NIL and the college footballs and how this is. I don't know. You heard the part probably about the some of the big companies now trying to get involved with the colleges, essentially putting money up and becoming essentially a sponsored league. How that deals tax wise, if something, I guess, to be determined. And so we were opining a little bit. Now, if say Northwestern wants in, and all of a sudden then they don't want in, and somebody else wants in, are people going to be able to move in and out depending on how their attitudes change over time, however was conceiving this league? And it struck me that it's somewhat similar to the way the soccer teams move up and down in Europe. And turns out Russell had a friend who listens to the show. What do you say, Greg? I'm long-time listener, first-time caller, and he went through how the different towns and so forth. If you have a really good team in the league just below the big league, next year they kick two of those guys out and put two of these guys in, and now you actually can move up and down. So if you and I decided to have an NFL team in Peoria or someplace, and we decided we got really, really good, that we could essentially make it to the NFL, which, of course, you can't do here because it's such a cartel, but... Anyway, the reason why I asked Bill to be on is we've talked a lot about, unfortunately, hurricanes and hurricane damage and these big swaths of roads being out and bridges being out and all kinds of stuff. And Bill is a longtime civil engineer and a very good one, by the way. And I just wanted to just generally find out, Bill, plus we got to talk about Marquette basketball, just a little bit about how you prioritize stuff like that and the different lead times and the different, I was told yesterday by Carl that I-40's out like for a while, right? I mean, and so is I-29. I don't think you can get from Tennessee to North Carolina. If you're in charge of that, pick a place, Florida, North Carolina. You're going to walk in and see all these roads, all these causeways. All this stuff is out, and you're going to say, well, God, I'd like to get that one going first, but wait a minute, that one's steel, and the steel is a year and a half to order the steel. How do you do all that? And what's the lead time on all the equipment? And how do you get the people? And how do you get the stuff? How would you even start on something like that?
Well, in my career, I've lived in some hurricane-prone areas. I actually moved to Miami in 1995, which was a couple years after Hurricane Andrew. And so I was kind of around that hurricane. To remind your listeners, I think came ashore with sustained winds of 185 miles an hour.
Yeah, it's one of two Category 5s that actually hit.
And it actually hit south of Miami in a community called Homestead, where there's a big military facility. But when I got there, it was 2 years later, and it was as if the hurricanes had happened the day before. I mean, it was still a lot of damage that was apparent. But to go to your question about, let's just say, the road network, which, you know, scales all the way from the interstate highway system down to local roads, the people that operate these road systems in, let's just say, in a given state is the state highway department. They are usually run by very savvy, experienced guys that know a lot about building roads, know a lot about operating roads, know a lot about maintaining roads. And one thing they have at their disposal is all kinds of what they call traffic count data. And they regularly go out and survey roads and put those little flexible tubes that you drive over sometimes. And they have all kinds of information on how many cars per day, per hour, et cetera. And I would imagine their approach would be, let's look at the most heavily traveled roads, the most critical roads, and see what we can do to get those back up. But when you wash away a piece of the road, as I've seen some videos, that is no small undertaking. And I'm sure part of their strategy, is there some detour that we can develop where we can move people around this repair location? They would be doing things like that. But then, of course, they'd get into all the logistics questions you were asking. You know, what do we need to rebuild? How quickly can we get it? And let me tell you, which is no small issue here, is just the manpower to come in and do the work. Because in our world right now, in the United States of America, there's as much construction going on as I've ever seen in my nearly 50 years as an engineer. I mean, there's lots of federal money out there. So all of the guys that dig the ditches and do the heavy lifting, there's not a lot of those guys standing around to jump into emergency repairs. But again, if it's a big enough emergency, people will pay money and get the right people into it. But it is a complicated thing. But typically those guys at the federal highway level and the state highway level really know what they're doing, and I expect they do a good job.
Well, Bill, when you put I know even with, you know, when you do the railroads, because I'm more familiar with that because I've read about that, and that, you know, more about highways for sure. You know, cut and cover, or if you saw a couple little hills, you'd cut those down either with horse-drawn, you know, blades or with a bulldozer, and you fill in the little valley between, and you even the whole thing out, right, basically. That was for railroads until all of a sudden. And the same thing, but when you go through a mountainous area, don't you essentially like blow up the side of the mountain to make something flat so you can actually make you make the roadway, right, somehow. Well, if that all gets washed out and you're back down to looking at just a mountain, how the hell do you even do that? How do you start again, or can you?
Yeah, well, you're going to have a big earthwork-type construction project to restore that. And it, you're right. I doubt anybody's using the horse-drawn articles anymore, but they'll bring in big equipment, and they can move mountains. And having worked with construction contractors all of my professional life, I have never observed a more ingenious group of people. I mean, when you present these guys that build things for a living, there is no end to the imagination and the ability to figure stuff out and get work done. And so it's a big undertaking, but they can do it.
Did you ever read, and I should have texted you this before, but if you never read it, just tell me. Did you ever read when the first railroad, I think, was the Baltimore, Ohio? They were trying to connect Chesapeake Bay with the Ohio River. And somewhere in the Appalachians, the Pennsylvania got involved and something, but they ran to a spot in the Appalachians where they just didn't know what the hell to do. And to this day, you ever see that thing? I'm sure you have, where it's like five or six tracks, the big horseshoe curve. It's like,
I can't say I've seen that, but
it's if you ever took the Pennsylvania train to Philadelphia, evidently they still use it. Somehow or another, they got the, you know, the different mountains they can maneuver, and all of a sudden they go, it's one spot, we just don't know what we can do. Well, they ended up chopping out and exploding up enough about two or three mountains and made this big horseshoe curve. Like you say, these guys are pretty ingenious. I mean, it's really something. I mean, we went to Hoover Dam together, didn't we?
We did.
when you have what is, when you talk about these 100-year storms, you know, 50-year storms and stuff, I remember one thing about Hoover Dam was they you know, they were aware they were going to build something there for what, like 40 years, 50 years, more than that. So they kept huge track of all the floods, the worst floods that ever went through that area, and some of them were really something to watch. And everything in the dam, as I recall, was designed to handle at least double the worst flood they ever saw.
Yeah, that would be the engineering approach to design for something beyond, you know, some extreme event, because, you know, once you put up a structure like that, and let's agree, it was that thing is pretty indestructible. You don't want it giving way. So yeah, they would have. We have an expression in the engineering business called belt and suspenders. So you would have been doubly careful, especially on such a significant job like that.
Well, so but the roads that we're talking about, just let's say North Carolina, I mean, or even in Florida, I doubt if the regular causeway getting from the mainland, you know, 200 yards to, you know, Longboat Key or something is designed to the same ultra spec. I wouldn't think, is it?
I can't really tell you about those. I've driven all the way to Key West many times, and I've never observed a problem with that road. And you know, it's been through lots of storms, and maybe not a direct hit, but to my knowledge, it has never failed. You know, the highway department in Florida, again, these are people that are experienced with hurricanes. They're ready for that. You know, one thing I was going to mention, and this is a little thought, that when I got there in 1995 after the Hurricane Andrew, the whole building community of Florida, because so much, you know, they were just scared to death of these storms after that, and they went back and revamped all of their building codes to make these new structures to the best extent they could, is you know, unable to be knocked down. So when hurricanes hit Florida, of course, they didn't do anything about the older structures. So, but what kind of happens, there's a process where as these hurricanes come through, they take out more and more of the older stock, and then it gets replaced with this much more substantial product built to the newer, more robust codes. And but still, it's a, you know, while I lived there, I should say I was evacuated 3 times from my office for hurricanes that were on the way, and literally guys come up the elevator and say, you got to get out of the building. Okay, yeah, when will that be? Like now. And get your stuff and get all your employees out of here. And of course, we had to, where would we go, you know? But in my case, I lived in a high-story condo, and I had what's known were hurricane shutters on my deck. So I just went home on my 12th-story condo, closed my hurricane shutters, and I was relatively impenetrable. But in the 3 cases where I evacuated, the hurricane always diverted at the last second and went somewhere else. So I never really got the full. But it is definitely a experience down there when you got a hurricane churning at you that, you know, everybody just freaks out. And no surprise what we're seeing the last month or so.
Well, I don't know if you remember my aunt and uncle, Dan and Sally, the ones that went to the racetrack all the time, and they loved to play poker. I think you probably played poker with them a couple times, at least my aunt. Well, her father he worked in some factory in Hammond or someplace, didn't have any much money. He retires to Florida and buys, I use the term shack and homestead. I mean, it was like people who retired to Florida, they had like no dough, were in homestead. It was like going through Arkansas or someplace.
Yeah, it was a rough place.
Where everybody's, the last 4 washing machines they owned were all lined up on the porch, that kind of place.
Right.
If you ever drove through like Arkansas, you see every car the person ever owned is still in the driveway, just the oldest ones right at the front, that type of thing. The home, no, we could have leaned on any one of those houses and knocked them down. They were all plywood and one window air conditioner. I mean, it was a really, I went through, she says, hey, go down and check out, because she wouldn't sell it, right? So she was renting it to somebody for like $50 a month. She goes, oh, check on my house. So I drive down there. I never saw any place like it. I said, I got a place that's still up. It's about all I could say for it. I can't imagine a worse place for a hurricane. If that thing would have been a hurricane category 1, it would have blown the whole place down. It didn't have to be a 5.
Yeah, there's a lot of substandard construction, older stuff that you know, is so vulnerable. But as each of these storms kind of comes through, you know, more and more of it gets blown away, and hopefully something's put back. The question I have, you know, as the insurance industry is kind of retreating from Florida, what does that do to the people's ability to rebuild? You know, if you're in one of those unfortunate situations where you're self-insured and your house gets knocked down, A, do you have the money to rebuild it? And B, do you have the interest in rebuilding something on your own dime that may be so vulnerable?
Well, my, you remember my brother Dan, his ex-wife, her cousin has a place right where the firm one hit 2 years ago. And she's on like the 12th floor or something, but all these people left and left their cars in the parking lot. So when the thing hit, all the cars rose up with the thing and started banging into like the 5th floor. So kind of wrecked the building, but it's 2 years later. They still don't know whether it's going to be condemned and have to tear it down or whether they can fix it. They haven't been able to live there. The elevators don't work. There's no power. I think you can go up the stairs once and come down with a bag of your valuables. That's about it. I can't imagine what's living in the place in terms of bugs and mold. They don't even know yet whether that's, they're going to have a place there or not. I was going to ask you what, just on your opinion, because nobody, Dan Janinas, who's usually on right now, I said, Dan, what's the bottom line going to be here? Somebody's got a place for $400,000. They can't afford the insurance. I guess if you're in a condominium development or something, they just raise your stuff. They pay whatever they have to, and now you know you're going to sell it for $100, and I'm going to buy it for $100, and say, at that price, I'll self-insure. Screw the insurance. I mean, is that the end game here?
It may be. You know, the whole condominium world in Florida, the high-rise condominium world, if you recall, maybe 5 years ago, that building in Surfside that just fell down one night.
Yeah.
I was sort of familiar with that neighborhood. I had a friend that lived a couple blocks away, and for whatever reason, I kind of knew that Surfside, which is adjacent to the city of Miami Beach. So that building was a couple blocks from the line between the two communities. And I want to say what I have read is that the state of Florida, Governor DeSantis, has kind of passed some legislation that has required all high-rise condos of a certain vintage to go through some serious and structural inspection. And if they find any, you know, exposed reinforcing steel or any issues with salt water intrusion into the building structure, they forced the buildings to fix all this stuff.
How do you fix it?
There are techniques for, you know, fixing columns that are failing. You know, you'd have to support them temporarily and do some chipping at the column itself, you know, getting all the loose material out of there, and then probably use some kind of epoxy to restore it, that sort of thing. But what's going on is, if I read the story correctly, so let's say in every condo has like an HOA, or they called it a building association. The condo I lived in, we had one, you know, and they took care of the roof, and they took care of, you know, general building things. But with these new rules, that condo association has to come in and hire structural engineers, people that are conversant in this kind of inspection, and they will come in and figure out what needs to be done. And then the state law requires it get done in some regular order. Well, the point is that these are, then the condo association makes an assessment against all the residents. In some cases, these are older people, don't have any money. You know, their condo was all they bought it, paid off. They weren't looking for any special assessment to pay. So in some cases, these buildings that get in this jeopardy situation, if the buildings are in a good spot, meaning you're on the ocean and you got a good view, but let's say it's an older building, the real estate investors will come in to the building and say, we'll start buying your units with the intention of getting all the units purchased, and then they'll take the building down and build a whole new building. But the world of the high-rise condo owner in Florida, aside from the hurricanes, has been kind of a questionable situation the last couple of years.
Bill, you remember Robin? I think you do. Anyway, she had a place
She was part of the trip to the Hoover Dam.
Yeah, she was. You know, she got killed in a car crash earlier in the year.
I remember hearing that on the show. Yeah.
But anyway, she had a place up on Belmont, and right where the Sheffield turns, Belmont, where right near the fancy hotel and something. There's a kind of, we're down a further place south there, beautiful building. All these people bought in the place. You know, they remodel it, just like you're talking about. Although it wasn't hurricanes, all of a sudden everything starts to go wrong. You know, they're going to put a new roof on, but oh, by the way, what do they call the things on the side of the roof that the brick that still go up? You know, the make it look real nice because the roof's actually below the wall kind of thing. Anyway, all that stuff had to be replaced. Something else had to be replaced. It was like. Special assessment, you know, free-for-all, buffet. It finally got to the point where you couldn't just sell the place and go. You had to put like a $30,000. The people who were buying the place required the old owner to put like a $30,000 chunk in escrow for the next 2 years in case there was an assessment that nobody knew about. Are they doing that in Florida, or did they do that?
Oh, I bet you they are, sure. I mean, I think there's a whole book of horror stories. I mean, one of the articles I read was one of these buildings where the speculators were buying up the units. And let's say they got 90% of them purchased. Sometimes in the condo regulations, when you get to 90%, you can kind of make the rules. So if you're the last 10% owners, the real estate speculators come in and say, guess what, we're in charge and we're going to do a couple things here, and starting with shut off the water. So we'd like to buy your unit, and we're not interested in paying what we would have paid you 6 months ago. We're going to give you a real low number. But this is not going to be a livable situation because there's not going to be any power, there's not going to be any water, etc. And then some of these heartbreaking stories where the one I read, this lady who had a condo is now effectively renting a room in a house in Miami Beach, and she goes to her storage facility every day to get her stuff, you know, because she's been sort of chased out of her home.
Wow.
And it's a mess. It's just a big mess, and the hurricanes just make it worse.
Well, Bill, I've seen some pictures of some of these mountains in Carolina, and I have to assume that if, you know, you or I buy a home on a hill, it's not that big of a deal for you or me to decide to put a driveway up to the place. I mean, we're not going to go crazy on the design of that. We're just going to put the driveway and throw some asphalt down, and away we go. Buy ourselves a Jeep, right?
Yeah, I think that, you know, you'd have to pay attention to the gradient. Obviously, if you're in an area that can get some snow or sleet, if you make it too steep, it becomes undrivable.
Yeah.
And probably the local government people wouldn't let you do it. So you've got to engineer something that's a little flatter, a little more drivable, that type of thing.
But now you get to a local road, they have to have some sort of an idea of, you know, when it rains, what happens, and those kinds of things. Like all this stuff we saw in Scottsdale, where they have all the dry washes all set out that if there's going to be water, this is where it's going to go, that sort of thing. Then you get to probably a state road, and then a U.S. highway, and then an interstate. They all have to be of like different degrees.
Yeah, you're stepping up in quality as you go up the ladder, for sure.
But what I saw in some of these mountains, they're talking about rivers of mud that were taking out trees and everything else. Was this storm over there? I mean, I think what happened, according to Carl, was the Hurricane Helene hooked up with a low pressure center that was already there, so it was almost like the perfect storm. The movie the boat went down in the northeast or northeaster.
Now, right. I remember.
So I mean, are we talking about people expecting possibly 9 inches of rain, 10 inches of rain, and this was like 20, where nobody ever even dreamed that you could have something like that? Even you, in your worst case, designing a thing, wouldn't have said, I got to worry about that. I mean,
certainly that's a possibility, that the actual rainfall event far exceeded any design level that you were looking at, that would have been established by either the city government, the county government, state government. You know, all of these roads are designed to standards. And when you're in the business of designing a road, and you're designing it in Cook County, you know, you get the Cook County standards. Or if it's in other places, cities, they all have their own rules and regulations, and you simply follow those, and that's how you get it approved. And but it is certainly possible that the local rules did not anticipate the event that they had.
Well, what about I-40? We might have Carl pile on after the break a little bit, because he's got a couple of specific areas and specific roads I think he wants to ask you about it. But I don't think you can get from Tennessee to North Carolina. The I-40 is gone.
Yeah, I don't think they'll be able to live with that too long. But again, not understanding how much damage. I mean, if they think there's going to be a long, drawn-out repair process, a replacement process, they'll be looking at some different ways to move the traffic around if they can. If not, it's going to be a difficult situation. But I would bet there's some kind of detour that they figure out, that they get in there with some kind of detour, so they got some traffic moving, and then get the work going.
Well, how just on the general view of the interstate system when it was built, you know, and you and I were real young, obviously, when this was happening, but there were all kinds of, I'll use the term, you know, U.S. roads, you know, that were U.S. highways, Route 30, Route 6. I mean, there's all kinds of them, you know, better than me. But most cases, the interstate was built, I'm going to say, somewhat adjacent or, you know, sort of in the same direction. I mean, so I-80 runs usually, what, 4 or 5 miles south of Route 30, maybe not even that far. Maybe it's a couple miles. But in some areas, they actually took the old U.S. highway and it became the interstate where there really isn't another way through. I mean, if it's a mountain pass and you've got a four-lane U.S. highway and you want to put an interstate, guess what? That's probably where it's going to go. I mean, Route 66 to St. Louis, that essentially became Route 55, right? I mean, there's a few, you know, cutoffs.
That makes total sense. You know, if you're going to put an interstate cross section through, why the logical place to start would be the road that's already there. You're going to widen, and but again, you've got the right of way, or at least a portion of it established. So you're not going, you know, trying to plow through a bunch of private property to get right of way. You know, in the engineering business, lots of times we have to buy property to do things, you know, like roads or other things. It's a pain in the neck, very tough, and a lot of owners are unwilling to sell. But you go in with what's known as eminent domain, and it would, which turns into what was a court proceeding, and basically the government can take it. At the end of the day, they can take it. It's just a question of how much they're going to pay for it. And at the end of the day, that strip of land or piece of property, it will be taken over for the road, and you as the landowner will be paid something. I'm on this eminent domain thing, but this is kind of a funny story. Do you remember the guy that Shaney shot with the shotgun in the face?
Shaney.
Vice President Cheney.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
He was kind of a hunter.
Yeah.
And he went hunting with a guy from here in Austin. And the Cheney accidentally discharged his shotgun into the face of this attorney. Didn't kill him, but obviously put a few little... But this guy was a very savvy attorney, and he owned some property in downtown Austin. The city of Austin took his one square city block by eminent domain, and they wanted to build a parking garage. So they went through the process, but the city made a mistake in the eminent domain process. If you make a mistake in that process, you're screwed. So anyways, the city took the property, built a parking garage, and put their little gates up, and it was the parking garage next to the convention center. So Cheney wrote him a letter and said, by the way, you don't own the land. Get off. That's mine. And he effectively evicted the city and took over the parking garage.
Wow.
And basically he was collecting the tolls for the parking.
You are obviously aware how the Tri-State Tollway in this area, because you're from Chicago, grows like every year, right? Well, there was an attorney, and unfortunately, the guy died young. And he's a good friend of same friends that I have that you know. But the guy had like 7, 8, 9 kids, 10 maybe. He had the condemnation book for the entire Tri-State Tollway. So like every year they go to widen the thing, he had to go back to the same people and condemn all his land.
Right.
I mean, it was just absolutely incredible stuff. But do you remember the guy way back when we were real young, when they were building I-57? If you went across the bridge at 103rd Street, the guy who didn't, he obviously did not sell the property to the state when he was supposed to, and they dug the thing around his house. It was like it was sort of hanging off into the thing, but... I guess back to my original question, if you go sort of on the same footprint, you really don't maybe have an alternative road next to you, do you?
No, you would try to work within the space that you've got, but probably if you're going from a state highway to a large interstate highway cross section, I'm guessing that would be wider. So there would be property acquisition on each side where you would go in and buy strips of land to widen things. Actually, in the city of Austin right now, we have sort of a interesting project. We have the interstate comes through the center of Austin. So it literally originates at the Mexican border and goes eventually to Chicago, you know. Well, when they erected it back in the 50s, it was an aerial structure. And people in the city of Austin said, well, the reason they did that, they were making a barrier between the poor people and the wealthy people.
Sounds like the Dan Ryan, doesn't it?
Right.
Hey, Bill, can you hold that thought? We got to go to break, but SP Futures up 28 and NASDAQ Futures up 178. Be right back, Stocks and Jacks.
This self-directed trading is a lonely job. Online trading is not as easy as point and click.
No, it's not. Everyone, even professionals, need to share ideas and think out loud every now and then.
That's what I like about PTI ProDirect. Their staff of former option floor traders really helps me choose the right strategy for trading option volatility and plan the time decay for my covered writing program.
Yep, nothing can replace years of trading experience to stop you from making that dumb trade and for saving a few bucks. We've all been there and done that.
Yeah, I have access to all that great trading advice and experience for just a penny a share for stocks, $1 for equity options, and $1 minimum a trade.
Our clients at PTI ProDirect can call when they need a little help on a trade or just to talk about the market in general. We trade every day. We love this stuff.
That's what I like most about PTI ProDirect. Cheap prices along with great advice from real floor traders. It's the best of both worlds.
Tell your friends. That's PTIProDirect.com, PTIProDirect.com.
Stocks, jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
Stocks and jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now. Right here, right now. Right now.
Hello and welcome back to Stocks and Jacks. I'm talking about Greg Pappas on the board. We have interesting interviews here this morning, like we always do, so we're going to be real quick here. I think retail sales came out 0.4 instead of 0.3, Greg. Is that the... is that the story here? But we definitely have a rally going on here. S&P's up 30, NASDAQ futures up 183. And we have the Dow futures up 81. Dow futures are lagging a tad, not a whole lot, but they have a new record yesterday. Real quick, we'll do Europe and Asia, and then we'll blow through this. European markets all higher. DAX up 136.7, FTSE up 37.5. Kekkonen really moving up 93.1.3. Asia, rock'em sock'em here. Nikkei down 269. Hang Seng up 207, that's a full percent. I'm sorry, down 207. And Shanghai down 33, that's a full percent. So big down moves over there. Everybody else is up, imagine that. Bonds, we've got up 6 basis points with this retail sales number, 4.07. It keeps creeping. It tried to get under 4, but it didn't. The Bund up 4 basis points, 2.21. Japan up 2 basis points, 0.97, making it towards 1 here, we think. Oil up 6 cents, quiet 70.45. Brent up 6 cents, 74.28. Natural gas up 2 cents, 2.39. We've got gold up 4.50. Backed off at 2,700. It was 2,703 an hour ago. Now it's 2,695. And we've got crypto is down 6.91, but still elevated at 67,088. Greg, real quick, traffic, weather, sports. By the way, how did Lonzo Ball do last night?
Lonzo Ball?
He played last night.
Oh, I'll check that on for you, too.
2.5 years he hasn't played.
Yeah. 7:37 here in Chicago. 37 degrees outside right now. High of 64 today. Phoenix, 70 degrees. High of 91 there today. Traffic getting worse. Inbound Kennedy from Montrose is 50 minutes. Edens from Lake Cook, 65 minutes. Eisenhower from Wolf, 44 minutes. Dan Ryan from 95th is 32 minutes. And the Stevenson from 294 to the Ryan is 51 minutes. We have... the Dodgers beat the Mets. That was 8-0. We have Bulls beat the Timberwolves by 2. That was 123-125. Broncos Saints is tonight at 7:15. And I actually didn't see. I looked into the Oakland, and it looked like the stadiums for Chicago, the stadiums for the Rays next season are actually in North Carolina.
Really?
So they're thinking about a few different parks there. Again, nothing set in stone, but it looks like Durham Bulls Athletic Park, which is the AAA.
Well, that's brand
Charlotte.
New. That's brand new.
Yeah, that's the AAA for...
maybe it'll come to where
that's
Carl
A's. Yeah, A's AAA, Charlotte Sports Park, which is south of St. Pete. So that's a training facility. The Worldwide Sports Complex, that's Orlando. And then... Doak Field is North Carolina State.
We have civil engineers, and we have Carl. Bill, are they just going to blow up that building with the fabric, or they're not even trying to fix it?
That's a good question. That's not what I've heard originally. I've actually been to a baseball game there, and a lot of people complain about that park, but the day I was there, I thought it was okay.
There's no drainage built into the bottom of the field, so if they do play with it open, they got big problems because if it rains, they're just out of luck.
Ugh. That's not
good. not a good situation.
Do we have Carl as well?
You do.
Hey, Carl, I thought maybe you might have a couple of questions for Bill. The man's got a world of knowledge about civil engineering. I guess first question, Bill, let's hope, I know you civil engineers, I'm with you guys, they're pretty inventive sort, but do you ever get a piece of roadway or anything where you say, wow, we thought the most we could ever get was 12 inches of rain, now it looks like we got 20. If we're going to get 20, we can't build here. Is that ever happen?
I think the way they would look into that would be to say, let's design something that will handle that extreme event. And, you know, obviously all of these things are dictated by the cost. And if it's too expensive to design it properly, you may have to abandon the project. But obviously some of these cases, the road's got to go from point A to point B one way or the other.
Well, so. The I-40 problem at the Pigeon River is one that has happened before. And it's basically impossible to move it because there's a mountain in the way on the other side. So how you resolve that is somewhat questionable. There was a lot of scuttlebutt flying around during the event that there's a dam just south of where that road collapsed that's owned by Duke Energy. And there was an awful lot of scuttlebutt that it had failed. It did not. Later, you know, Duke said, no, it's still there. And then not too long after that, some pictures showed up that, yeah, it was still there. So, yeah, that was also the same. That's the same tributary that ended up flooding Newport up near me. But it was just runoff from, you know, from both sides. The dam did... You know, they did have to go down the spillway route. They had to go to over, you know, basically down the bypass. But the runoff on the other side of it was the largest contributor. And the problem with that is the roadbed was destroyed. It wasn't just the road. So it was undercut. And, you know, as I don't know, I haven't been listening to your entire segment, but as I'm sure you know, you don't just lay down concrete over the top of ground, right? So,
right.
Yeah, so everything underlying that is gone. Now, my understanding is that they are, within the next couple of weeks, basically one direction, the southbound lanes were undercut and collapsed. The northbound lanes are still there. They have done the engineering assessment, and those are stable. So they are going to reroute, and this particular section, by the way, is notorious for being one-laned because they're rebuilding this or that, or, you know, redoing this or widening that. It's been that way for at least the last 10 years. Every time I go down that road, and I do on a fairly regular basis. So they're going to one-lane it, but they're not going to allow commercial traffic down it. It's going to be local access only. So that does not help with truck traffic at all. The other problem on I-26, which is near Irwin, is extremely serious because the approach to a bridge was undercut and collapsed. Not the bridge, not the span itself, but the approach. And that was near Irwin. That was where they had the hospital that got flooded. That particular problem is there is no fast way to fix that guy. So I don't know, you know, the projections I'm seeing are, you know, maybe 2 or 3 years. And the only bypass to both of those to get into North Carolina is up 81 and then down 77, which is it's a pretty serious detour. I mean, just coming down 75 up to 81 is easily... to the 77 interchange, it's got to be a 2-hour run. So,
can you give us some kind of a quick overview on lead times? I mean, if you're talking about,
the published dates are the 2028 for I-26.
No, I'm talking about the basic stuff. I'm asking Bill if you're going to build a bridge, when do you normally order the steel? I mean, obviously the concrete, if there's a concrete place, you can probably get that fairly quickly if you've got the right aggregate. But what kind of planning? If the steel's washed out, are we talking a year, year and a half, 6 months? I mean, what is normal lead time for this stuff?
Well, it just depends, of course. Different kinds of bridges, different materials, steel, concrete. So all of those things kind of come into play. But it would be significant, especially if it was a complex bridge. So,
well, now here's one interesting thing. So there was some damage at Hot Springs. Route 25, which is a state road, is a bypass of the I-40 mess. Okay, and that comes in down to 26, which is the other access into the Asheville area. Route 25 is now open. Now there was bridge damage at Hot Springs, but I'm looking at it while we're on this here, and it appears that has been reopened. The problem with that is that that is a state highway. It is multi-lane. However, it also has some pretty significant elevation changes, and at least on the western end, once you get into the first part of Tennessee, is relatively narrow and not a whole lot of fun if you happen to be a large rig. So and by the way, it follows the French Broad. The other thing that goes along with this, you were talking about them anticipating some of these issues. In the 1970s, some very hardcore left-wing activists killed the expansion of the TVA dam network on the French Broad, including directly in Asheville. And it was the city and county commissions and activists that were energized by them that did that. This was despite the fact that in 1916 and in the 1940s, there were two really nasty floods. The 1916 one was approximately equal to what we just had happened. The French Broad River was a mile wide in the center of Asheville. Yeah, I mean, it was bad. And this was maybe worse by a foot or something like that. But I mean, look, what's the difference between 25 feet and 26 feet, right? I mean,
a foot.
It doesn't. I mean, okay, your roof is 15 feet underwater. No, your roof is 10 feet underwater. You're 12 feet underwater.
Well, Bill, with the stuff that Carl's describing, who takes charge of that? Is it somebody like you from a firm? Do you work with the highway people? I mean,
People would, if you're going to kind of establish new standards based on a record event. You know, the state highway department would lead that effort. They would bring in experts and engineers to do those kind of evaluations to come up with better, more robust standards. I mean, that happens all the time. You know, we design things and Mother Nature outpaces our design, and we go back and when we repair it or replace it, we make it stronger, better, so it'll last. So that's I think the process you'll go through.
Well, that's the same thing they did with the. I remember all everybody talked about was an earthquake in the Golden Gate Bridge, and it turns out somebody spent a fortune on some big study on the Golden Gate Bridge, and the study came out and said the bridge will be fine. The access roads to the bridge are the ones that are in danger, and then they spend like 2 or 3 years kind of redoing all the access roads to make them more earthquake. I guess the bridge would just shake a bunch of lot and be okay, unless it's a massive thing. I mean, are people regularly doing these kinds of studies, Bill? Whenever you see, in other words, this happened here, and Carl was. By the way, thank you, Carl, for giving us all this detail. So now,
yeah, no worries.
But everybody else now, is everybody else around the country going, that could have happened here, and what if it happened here? What shape is our stuff in? Is that happening as well, or should it?
I don't know if it's like that all around the country. Certainly in the impacted areas, But people that deal with infrastructure, which of course is a whole world of things, not just roads, you know, we're always looking at flood-proofing things. We're always looking at various kinds of events, earthquakes, et cetera, that can, you know, cause things to fail, kill people, that sort of thing. And those kind of people in those agencies, from the water and sewer director, the highway director, the building departments, they're always looking at these things. And if there's an issue, you know, they want to get it out there and get it figured out, because they're not going to look so good.
Carl and I, Bill, are always, not always, but once in a while we talk about people entering these industries. I mean, my nephew was in a, they make steel parts for people, and getting people as these, you know, to get a guy who is, 65, 70 years old and is retiring, to say he's the mechanic for your 15 or 20, 40-year-old machines that you still use every day, replacing that guy is pretty damn tough. Are the young groups of engineer guys that are piling into these state highway people, I mean, are these jobs still attractive enough to get people that are smart enough to do this? I mean, Carl and I, we're always talking about this. Is it still a go-to profession?
I don't think so. I think what happened to the engineering world some years back was a lot of those people that were built for that kind of service became attracted into computer software. So, and I don't have any statistics, but a lot of the people that became your regular engineers didn't become engineers. They went into programming and software and all that sort of stuff, which of course now is breeding all this AI stuff. So I can tell you, in industries that I'm familiar with, the point that you just made about the 65-year-old mechanic and who's coming behind, there is a huge effort to try to create records and create pathways to people, you know, because these 65-year-old mechanics, they remember things and all that stuff. And some jurisdictions have gone to the point where they're making videos of the guy, you know, fixing a motor or fixing a pump, and, you know, here's how you do it. But it's definitely going to be a problem. I know here in the city of Austin, there's a fair bit of construction work kind of coming in the future. The city itself has established an academy, and I think the academy is free, that if you're a high school graduate, you can come to the academy and for nothing be taught to be an electrician, be taught to be a heating, ventilation mechanic, be a plumber, whatever. And from what it sounds like, the construction companies are really into this because they see an opportunity to get employees out of this academy. So I think that's kind of a good idea. I'm sure it's being done other places, but they're definitely a need for people in this whole industry, you know, the construction and building and engineering and repair and maintenance, because so many of the people that normally would have went into that, I think, have been diverted to other things.
Well, if you had to guess, either one, if Carl's still here, out of 100 bright engineering students waddling into Purdue or Michigan or Notre Dame or Illinois or someplace, what percentage of the 100 do you think are in civil engineering? I'm going to guess 5, 10? I mean, I don't know. I'm asking you guys, but I bet there's not many.
Well, it's part of the problem is that we just, you can have somebody that says, well, this needs to be done, or this needs to be taken into account, or whatever have you, okay? But if it's ignored, it doesn't make any difference. And the civil engineers are the ones that, you know, do that work, but they're not the ones that make the decisions. And so, you know, you have a situation like what happened with Asheville, where I'm sure somebody said, you know, if you guys aren't going to put those dams in, then allowing the water intake plant for your municipal water system and the substations for your electrical plant to be within the floodplain is criminally stupid. And somebody is going to, you know, eventually the water shall rise. And when it does, because it has before, and when it does, those things are going to be destroyed. And
Bill, I don't know if you heard about that part, but some of the electrical substations from Duke Energy were actually built in the floodplain.
Malpractice would be the only term I would use for that.
Well, but again, how many of them were put there before the 1970s when TVA came in and said, here, you know, we want to fix this problem on a prospective basis, and the city and county said no.
So they wanted to build a new dam or expand one.
They wanted to build several new dams. It wasn't one. There were a series of them that they wanted to put down in their French Broad and the tributaries. It wouldn't have stopped any of the mudslide problems that you know happened up in the holler areas in North Carolina, because that that's where an awful lot of people got displaced and even killed. And I don't know what you do about that. I mean, that's that was just a consequence of the the storm configuration. But in terms of the lowland flooding, it likely would have prevented most or all of it. And that was, they were, the TVA had the funding for it and everything, and they abandoned the project because of opposition, and it was organized. So, I mean, this was, this was green groups that were like, oh, no, you don't, you're going to have to displace, 400 families in order to do this, because obviously when you dam the river, there will be a reservoir created behind it and things like this. And they killed it. And this was not in the 1910s. This was in the 1970s.
Wow!
And it actually was featured. It still is. It's the page is still up at Asheville's History Museum. That's such a great achievement. Well, I wonder how great they think it is now.
Bill, if you had to build a dam today, where the hell would you find an engineering firm that specializes in building dams?
Oh, there's several around the world, because we may not be building many in the U.S. They're building them all over the place. And there's big engineering firms right there in Chicago that could build you any kind of dam you want, and I think would do quite a good job of it. But
what's
how to do it.
To design something like that, what's the lead time on all that stuff? I mean, concrete's no lead time, right? As long as you got the stuff, you just make it. But steel's a big deal, right?
I would say it would be, but I again, depending on the type of dam, the structure, et cetera, what's in it, how big it is. But again, doing a major hydroelectric dam, I mean, just the planning of something like that is over a decade. Easy. While you figure all the stuff out before you even start drawing any engineering drawings. I mean, those projects are kind of generational. They just don't, pop up over a quick period of time.
How far along were they?
First of all, these studies, you'll establish all those lead times at certain kinds of critical materials.
How far along were they when they killed this one? Were they like 5 years along, Carl?
No, the TVA had gotten the funding secured. They had done the design work in terms of where they had to put them, but they hadn't actually started building anything yet.
But they hadn't done all the intricate stuff like Bill's talking about.
It was basically, okay, we need to put dams here, 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 and here in order to, mitigate the risk of this happening. And they're, obviously when you do that, you impact some people, you end up having to condemn some land. And then on top of that, though, you also generate opportunities, recreational opportunities, because now you have a reservoir, and guess what? There's going to be people who want to fish and, such on the reservoir. And so there's a mixed bag that comes out of it.
Wasn't the, you guys will know this, isn't the single biggest in this country movement of people thing, evacuation of people, wasn't it the TVA?
I believe it probably was, yeah. But, the TVA was an absolutely enormous, undertaking when it was first done. And it essentially turned the valleys in the area, not just in Tennessee, but in the general area where it operates, into inhabitable space where they formerly weren't, because every spring the snow would melt up on the mountains.
Hey, we all saw Deliverance.
Well, that was real.
Bill will know this. What's the second biggest movement of people, Bill?
I think it's when we got out of college, Tom.
I think it was the Dan Ryan Expressway.
Right.
How many people do they have to move for that?
Quite a number.
What do you think? It's a mile wide.
Super happy about it.
Are you? Do you ever miss your roots? You ever coming back to Chicago?
I don't know that I ever see myself living in Chicago. I still have my seven brothers and sisters, so once or twice a year I sneak up there for a weekend or that sort of thing. My sister lives in a condo building at 1111 South Wabash, so she's right there in the city. But most of my family members live in the suburbs, a couple of them in Evergreen Park, actually, just to tie that back in.
Well, that's where my brother lives there now. We've been there every Sunday. We have some dinner there and stuff. Evergreen's still, you know, a good place.
Yeah, that's my observation.
Well,
for
next
sure.
time you come. First of all, I'd love to have you back. You and Carl, I think, without me, we'd have a better show. But Carl knows where all the stuff is, and you know the solutions. It's pretty interesting. I think that your career being a civil engineer, if you worked on good stuff, I think probably be a lot of fun, wouldn't it, Carl? I mean, Carl was a computer guy, and obviously he did very well there. But
oh, I'd have all sorts of fun with that. Yeah.
You know, the firm you used to work for, Bill, didn't they do the Chicago subways?
They did a lot of big work in Chicago. I worked for a firm called Conzer Townsend, which was founded in Chicago in the 20s, and they did all kinds of big work. Dan Ryan, all the expressways, the airports, sanitary district of Chicago. It was a big company. I mean, we had, when I was working in the loop, I mean, we had 500 guys in the Velsicol chemical building at 360 East Grand. I mean, it was a big operation.
What, everybody got old and did they get bought by somebody? What happened?
They got bought by AECOM, which is publicly traded. So now the world event, it used to be in the 70s, a big engineering firm was 1,000 guys. Now a big engineering firm is 80,000 people. They've all been built by acquisition over the years, but there are three or four that are all 70,000 employees all over the world, do everything possible, dam, sewer plant, road, you name it, anything you want, they can do it. They've got people. It's just a whole different world. The whole engineering business is consolidating into these large mega companies.
Well, how come you never end up being a ambassador to Ireland like the Kenny brothers?
That's a job I would love. You know, I go to Ireland every 2 years. I rent a house in Dingle, which is next door to the village my grandfather left in the 20s. So I rent this little house in Dingle, and for a week or two, I kind of tromp around the West Coast in County Kerry and always have a nice time over there. Always interesting to go over there, see what's going on, but good place to go on vacation.
Well, Bill, thank you. We'll have you back on. Carl, thank you. You added a bunch. I think obviously, you guys probably done better without me, but that happens a lot. I guess that's
no worries, my friend.
Last question. Is there any company we should be buying? Is it just general steel stuff or what?
No, I think the biggest issue here is that the economic impact of this disruption, I mean, just the transportation disruptions alone.
Well,
now Milton, Florida has a lot of practice with these things, and they tend not to be quite as stupid. They're almost completely stood back up. But I think there's a possibility this by itself causes a recession.
Well, let's hope not. We'll talk about it tomorrow. S&P futures up 33, NASDAQ futures up 219. Retail sales were good. Everybody likes the market. Can't wait to see the money supply numbers this month. I have a feeling they're going to be frightening. That's another story. Back tomorrow, Stocks and Jocks.
That's all, folks.